this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, welcome back to Y'allitics. We are at a new place today. We haven't been here before. This is Oak Highlands Brewery. This is Northeast Dallas, kind of on the southern edge of Garland. We were trying to figure out if it's Dallas or Garland, but I think we're still technically in the People's Republic of Dallas as far as the post office is concerned here. You're already drinking. It's about 8:15 in the morning. Wheeler, what are you having, man?
Just for the record, so are you already. I'm having the Fest beer. Which they've got that sitting next to the Oktoberfest, but they told me that Fest beer is actually the one that is served at Oktoberfest in Germany.
Interesting, because they have an Oktoberfest.
Oktoberfest beer.
So it's not a Märzen, it's a lighter beer than that.
Sure.
You know what's interesting about
I think what you said's right.
Well, Wheeler passed up several fruity beers they have on the menu too. There's a strawberry beer and a jalapeno beer. So this is going to be a really interesting podcast.
Yeah, I don't know that jalapeno beer counts as a fruity beer.
I'm having a...
Just for the record.
True. I'm having a Tejano Pecano. It's a native Texas pecan.
That sounds sweet.
Beer. It's not sweet at all. Oh, it's kind of like the... What's that British beer, the pecan beer?
I don't know.
Or nut beer? I don't know.
You got me on that one. You got me on British pecan beer trivia this morning.
Listen, we don't do a lot of book reviews on our podcast here. If you listen, you know that. But this is a presidential election year, and there aren't a lot of folks who seem to be that excited about this rematch. Now, people on both sides of the camps are really excited about their candidate, but I think the 30% in the middle may not be terribly excited about this.
I think even some people on both sides in their camps are not excited about this one.
I think that's fair too. But today, let's go ahead and welcome in our guest. It's Talmadge Boston. He is a historian, an author, and an attorney.
Yeah.
So Wheeler thinks he has the busiest job around, but I think Talmadge is busier than that because this morning at 4:45, I got an email from you. And I felt like I was really delayed responding to it at 6:04 in the morning. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Well, before I judge who's busier here, were you going to bed at 4:45 or getting up?
I was up.
Oh, okay, then you're busier than I am. I'm likely to send an email at that time because I'm going to bed at that time. But anybody who's getting up and starting work at that hour, okay, hats off to you.
Here's the book. It's How the Best Did It. It's Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents.
Yeah.
And before we get too deep into it, let's give some background on Talmadge here. You've been practicing law since 1978, I read.
Coming up on 46 years, all in Dallas, Texas.
Wow. Man, congratulations on that. You're currently a partner at Shackelford, Bowen, McKinley, and Norton LLP. You've written 5 books. And this one is your most recent one.
And you're in the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, or Baseball Hall of Fame, which I find fascinating because you are a sports writer as well. You get into all kinds of history.
Well, my first two books were baseball history books, and that's where my true love started as far as writing for publication. But after I finished the second, I realized I'd written about everything in baseball that I really cared about, and so I was ready to move on. So my third book was on legal history, and my last two books have been on presidential history, and that's really where my passion lies these days, and I suspect it's where it's going to stay.
Yeah, and there's so much to say in this realm, and I really like what you've done with this, too, because this is not just a history book. Let's look back and you know, talk about some people who have served in this highest office. This is sort of a how-to book for becoming a better leader. It talks about the different qualities for each one of 8 former presidents, and you know, what it was that set them apart, that made them great. And it's stuff that the rest of us could incorporate in our own lives, and you know, God knows some of us need to, Whiteley, to become better leaders too. And you go through Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, both Roosevelts, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Reagan in this. And it's fascinating when you can break out each one of them and take a look at each one of those individual presidents. And we talked about this. You know, a lot of people have their own thoughts about some of these former presidents. And they'll think, well, you know, I might disagree with you, you know, what you wrote on that. Why are you the expert? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I chose these 8 presidents, who I call our 8 greatest presidents, largely on the basis of the C-SPAN presidential ranking poll. Every time one president leaves the White House and a new one comes in, C-SPAN does a presidential ranking poll and the people who get to vote in the poll are our 150 leading historians. And they vote on the presidents from best to worst based on 10 presidential leadership categories. The last two times they've done the poll, 2017 when Obama left and Trump came in, 2021 when Trump left and Biden came in, the results of the C-SPAN poll were identical for the top nine. Number one, Lincoln, number two, Washington, three, FDR, four, Theodore Roosevelt, five, Eisenhower, six, Truman, seven, Jefferson, eight, Kennedy, nine, Reagan. The only tweak that I made on the C-SPAN poll, I think Truman is overrated. I think Reagan is underrated. Truman got us into Korea and didn't know how to get us out. Truman did not deal effectively with McCarthyism and the Red Scare. Eisenhower solved both of those problems. Truman gets some credit for dropping the A-bombs and bringing a quick end to World War II. I think that was a no-brainer. There's no way he wasn't going to drop the bombs. Otherwise, we're going to have to invade Japan and lose hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives. That wasn't going to happen. The best thing that ever happened to Harry Truman was David McCullough wrote a biography of him that won the Pulitzer. And that's a big part of why he's ranked so highly. So anyway, but the other reason is that in this presidential election year, I want my book to be appealing to both Democrats and Republicans. So I have a good balance in the modern era, two great Democratic presidents, FDR and JFK, two great Republican presidents, Eisenhower and Reagan. And it's also a statement toward our polarization today, and that is, I want Democrats to recognize we've had some great Republican presidents, and I want Republicans to recognize we've had some great Democratic presidents. And so anyway, that's how I picked my eight. Some people may wonder, well, why should I believe a Dallas lawyer's conclusions about presidential leadership? And the short answer is, when I finished with each of my eight chapters on the eight presidents, I sent them to at least two major biographers of that president, who I've done many programs with, interviewed on their past books. They know me well. I know them. And I said, did I miss something? Did I misstate something? Can you give me your tweaks? Do you disagree with anything I've said? And I got their tweaks, and I inputted them into the final version that went to the publisher. So the conclusions in this book have been thoroughly vetted by the country's leading presidential historians, including three Pulitzer Prize winners, John Meacham, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Annette Gordon-Reed, as well as Doug Brinkley, Mark Updegrove, Ronald White, Will M. Bowden, and David Stewart.
Did any disagree at all?
None of them disagreed. None of them said you missed something. Yeah. Some of them had some fine-tuning points that I incorporated, but nothing major and no errors found. And my process was, since I'm still a full-time lawyer, I don't have time to go to these presidential libraries and dig through these original letters and illegible cursive handwriting.
Sure.
The good news is I don't have to do that because that's been done by these other biographers who are essentially full-time biographers. So my process was, for each of these presidents, I took the leading six to eight biographies of those presidents, and I read them thoroughly, and I compared notes, and there really wasn't much conflict in terms of what were these presidents' most important leadership traits that caused them to be successful. And that's what's in each of my chapters, typically an average of three traits per president, for a total of 24 traits over the eight presidents, no duplication. And so, knowing that I was relying on our most esteemed biographers of these presidents,
you felt confident.
I felt very confident.
Yeah. Well, let me ask about one review on there. It's a fellow author, George Washington biographer David O. Stewart, and he said something interesting that really resonated with me, because people know these presidents, people have studied these presidents, they know their exploits, they know what they've done well, etc. But David points out about your book, he says, Talmadge Boston demonstrates rare gifts in sifting gold nuggets from the endless gravel beds of known facts about eight leading presidents, then delivering them concisely and persuasively. Jason laid out the presidents, FDR, Eisenhower, JFK, Ronald Reagan, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt as well. You said three traits per president. Let's go through the list here. Give me one or so off the top. Let's start with, we'll start at the top. George Washington. What did he do that really you highlighted here?
Well, since I wrote the Washington chapter first, there's actually more of his traits than there are toward the back of the book, again, to avoid repetition. But the first trait I identify was he learned from his mistakes. George Washington didn't start out that great in the French and Indian War. when he was serving in the British Army, trying to defeat the French, he was guilty of over-promoting himself or trying to over-promote himself, and he was rejected time and again. He learned his lesson. For the rest of his life, he was never a self-promoter, which was an essential trait that allowed him to be chosen unanimously to lead our army in the Revolutionary War, unanimously to be the chairman of the Constitutional Convention, and unanimously for both his first and his second term. So learning from his mistakes, obviously we think of George Washington, we think of the cherry tree fable.
Sure.
Dad chopped down the cherry tree, I cannot tell a lie. It was a fable, but it was absolutely true. He was a man of the highest integrity, total credibility, and so whatever he said, you could take his words to the bank.
How about Jefferson?
Jefferson was not a great public speaker. Hmm. One of the interesting jewels in my research was that during his 8 years as president, he gave a grand total of 2 speeches.
Wow.
His 2 inaugural addresses were the only speeches he gave.
In 8 years?
In 8 years.
Whoa.
But Jefferson came to the presidency right after John Adams' presidency, where the country was getting dangerously divided, such that Adams, a Federalist, and the Congress was controlled by the Federalists. During that presidency, they passed the Sedition Act, which made it a crime punishable by incarceration for anybody to criticize President Adams or any Federalist policy. Hmm. Fortunately, that statute terminated at the end of Adams' presidency, but that was the nation that Jefferson was coming into, incredibly divided, such that in his first inaugural address, at the very beginning, he said, "Look, folks, we are all Federalists, we are all Republicans, we are all Americans, and we better start thinking that way or this country isn't going to last." And so he then proceeded over the next 8 years, because he wasn't a great public speaker, but he was a great interpersonal persuader. Hmm. By the time he was president, he was already a widower. And so 2 to 3 times every week for 8 years, he would get together dinners of between 10 and 20 people, Republicans, Federalists, people who didn't like each other. He had a ground rule. We are not going to talk about the hot button political issues. Hmm. We're going to talk about what we do for a living, what our families are like, history, literature, music, and over time, you don't get that on the first dinner, or the third dinner, or the sixth dinner, but over time, the walls started coming down, and rapport was developed. And there's 2 important political adages that still apply today. One, politics is all about relationships. If you have great interpersonal relationships, you're going to be likely to be more successful in politics. And the second is, if somebody likes you, they're more inclined to give you the benefit of the doubt.
I like that Jefferson policy. We've been trying to do that with Thanksgiving and Christmas, just with the family. Come to this dinner
at your house,
no one talk about politics. Yeah, but it hasn't worked yet.
I'd like to be invited to that one.
There.
I think I know Lincoln's, but you know, tell us what you found, because these gold nuggets are fascinating about Jefferson.
Well, when I got to Lincoln, since he was so virtuous and is recognized as our greatest president, an argument could be made that Lincoln had all 24 of the traits covered in this book, and no other president comes close to that. Hmm. But the traits that I identified that I thought had not been fully appreciated before, one was his magnanimity, which means he was forgiving. He didn't take the bait. He stayed above the fray. And that was important, obviously, during the Civil War. But
Well,
of course, there wasn't but a month between the end of the Civil War and when he got assassinated. But he had his famous team of rivals cabinet, who there was always some tension there. And he made sure he kept his eye on the ball. We got to reunite the country. We got to abolish slavery. We got to win the Civil War. So he didn't get bogged down in interpersonal strife with his cabinet. He had some smart aleck Union generals who were insulting to him, most notably George McClellan. He wouldn't take the bait with him. His wife was a very difficult person. She woke up every day thinking of ways to make new enemies and to undermine him. And yet again, he didn't get bogged down with marital strife issues. So he stayed above the fray. And then secondly, equanimity. Calm. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being president of the United States when 750,000 people are killed and millions are injured? Many suffer amputations, just dealing with the stress that this is all happening on my watch. Mm-hmm. And yet he never panicked, never got visibly angry to any group, and kept his head on the achieving the goals and showing us how to lead from an emotional intelligence standpoint among everybody who he was interacting with, but also from an eloquent standpoint. His famous speeches, Gettysburg Address, second inaugural address, the most eloquent president we've ever had.
And the weight that was on his shoulders was just extraordinary.
Let's skip ahead to the two partisans that people would probably know a lot more about. John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. Because they're both revered in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. What are the leadership traits that you pulled out of there that can be applied to anyone reading the book?
Well, Kennedy was president for less than 3 years before he was killed, 1,000 days. And so you think, well, how could somebody be rated so high who was president for such a short period of time? Well, the answer is, during his 1,000 days, he did many great things. So much of what we've read in recent years is about the dark side, the serial philanderer, taking the drugs from Dr. Feelgood, things like that. But the truth of the matter is, in terms of what he did as president, for the most part, he was a great president. You say, okay, so what did he do? One, he was our youngest elected president. He was 43 years old. Yeah. And anybody who's ever studied what he did in Congress before he became president realized he was a playboy. He didn't know anything. He didn't sponsor any major bills. He wasn't involved in any foreign policy. He wasn't anything. And so all of a sudden, he's young, he's charismatic, he knows how to project on television better than anybody before and arguably since, and so he wins. And then all of a sudden he wakes up the next day and says, oh, now what do I do? Mm-hmm. I've got to come up with an economic policy and a fiscal policy, which he knows nothing about. So he immediately surrounds himself with the country's leading economic thinkers, Walter Heller and James Tobin, and they become his Council of Economic Advisors, and he studies economics and fiscal policy nonstop, and in less than a year decides what the country must do, because it was in an economic plateau during the last 2 years of Eisenhower's presidency. Somebody needed to revive the economy, and Kennedy decided he'd go with the Keynesians, and it worked, and the economy took off. So incredible growth in a short period of time in grasping what became and implementing a very sound economic policy. Second, foreign policy. He'd been president a grand total of 3 months when we had the disastrous Bay of Pigs fiasco, an international humiliation where the CIA-trained insurgents went to the Bay of Pigs and were immediately seized by Castro's army, and it was just humiliating that we would be a part of such a ridiculous strategy. But he learned his lesson. He learned, hey, I did this because I relied on the so-called military experts. They thought this was going to work. I learned I shouldn't rely on them as a knee-jerk proposition. So 18 months later, when we have the Cuban Missile Crisis, he's learned his lesson. And he's not listening with a knee-jerk response during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He comes up with his own strategy. The experts were saying, you got to invade Cuba. You got to bomb Cuba. He's saying, no. We end up implementing a blockade which stops Soviet ships from sending any more missiles into Cuba. And then he begins intensive negotiations with Khrushchev, which leads to a trade. We took our missiles out of Turkey. They took their missiles out of Cuba. No lives were lost, and thereby World War III and nuclear holocaust was prevented. And then third, in the area of personal growth, civil rights. The first 2 years of his presidency, he did basically nothing because he's already thinking about, well, I want to get reelected in 1964, and to do that, I've got to carry the South, and the Southern Democrats are bigots, so that's why he froze for 2 years. But then, as he sees the Birmingham riots, where Sheriff Bull Connor is pouring the fire hoses on the black children and releasing the vicious attack dogs on the black adults, and it's all on national TV, and Kennedy recognizes, I can no longer do nothing. I've got to step up, and he persuaded America that this was not a political issue anymore, it was a moral issue. And so he submitted to Congress for the first time a strong civil rights bill, which he was killed before it went through. Fortunately, his successor, Lyndon Johnson, pushed it through and succeeded, and it became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So incredible personal growth that all resulted in great results as far as the economy went, foreign policy went, and civil rights went. Second major trait, calm in a crisis, which is thoroughly discussed in the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then third, his words inspired deeds. It's one thing for a president to be eloquent. It's something else when his eloquence actually causes good things to happen. Mm-hmm. Kennedy, in his first inaugural, asked not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. A couple of weeks later, he implements the Peace Corps. Tens of thousands of young America go abroad, enhance our public relations around the world. It's a year later, the space program, the moonshot, the speech at Rice Stadium. We choose to go to the moon in this decade, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. It's going to show how strong and smart we are, and we're going to do it. And we did. And then, of course, his speech on civil rights right after Birmingham, where he's saying, this is a moral issue. We've all got to get involved. There, we can't delay anymore. So those were Kennedy's traits. As far as Reagan goes, what I didn't fully appreciate until doing the research was what an unbelievable optimist he was. And it's one thing to be an optimist. It's something else to inspire optimism in your organization. And that's what he did. He grew up poor. His father was a hopeless alcoholic. His mother was a saint, thank goodness, and inspired him to do good things. But there was nothing about his growing up years that would cause anybody to be an optimist. But coming in the aftermath of the disastrous Jimmy Carter presidency, where we had double-digit inflation, high unemployment, low economic growth, long gas lines, and hostages that we couldn't get out of Iran, America was in a state of malaise, and up steps Reagan. We're going to be a shining city on the hill. We can do it. He gets elected, and lo and behold, he turns the economy around. He wins the Cold War. He revives the nation's self-confidence. So he had this optimism, can do, but he also had the long-term vision, which he stuck with and ultimately implemented, that produced those great results.
Let's close out the other three, and we'll start with FDR, who, interestingly, we were talking about this beforehand, Reagan was a huge fan of FDR as he was growing up.
Well, FDR was truly a great communicator, and Reagan's nickname, of course, was the Sure. Great Communicator. Mm-hmm. But FDR was great talking to the masses. He was also great on the radio with his calm conversational style. So eloquence to inspire people to be more hopeful about their conditions during the Great Depression, to be more hopeful about the prospects for us winning World War II. This was the time we needed that kind of voice to lead America. But FDR's other great gifts were what he did to know the public sentiment. And I don't just mean parts of the American people, I mean all parts. He was constantly having live press conferences open to any and all questions. Don't we wish we had that today? Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid of any questions. He wanted to know what was on their minds. Both he and his wife, Eleanor, were always, or Eleanor in particular, traveling around the country. What did people in Arizona think? What did people in Michigan think? What did people in Rhode Island think? He wanted to know that.
She was sort of the voter whisperer, wasn't
That's
she?
That's right. I mean, well said. Yeah. Well said. That's exactly what she was. And he was very strong about wanting to hear what the leaders of both political parties had to say. And public opinion polls were a newly emerging factor in politics, and he paid close attention to them. So any and all information that could help him understand the public sentiment was essential. And you have to know what the sentiment is before you can think about it. Well, how am I going to move it? And in particular, during the late 30s and early 40s, when Hitler's reign of terror was going on, most Americans were stuck in isolationism. They didn't want to go to war halfway around the world. They'd done that 20 years before. They didn't want to do it again. And so, but Roosevelt said, no, this Hitler guy's for real. Yeah. And if we don't get involved, Churchill and Britain aren't going to be able to beat him. And he's going to take over Europe, Asia, Africa, the high seas. He's going to be coming to the United States. We can't wait that long. So in his fireside chats, one at a time, incrementally, he got the needle moved on public opinion, such that by the time 1941 and Pearl Harbor rolled around, America was ready to go to war. We knew we had to do this to save ourselves as well as save the world.
You said that I word there, incrementally, and I've thought that with several of these men that you discuss in the book is, you know, we think of them as coming in with these huge ideas and these ambitions and this agenda, and they push it forward. Over and over again, though, you see in history, even, you know, with the likes of Lincoln, you know, there are critics now who say, well, he should have done more. He should have come out, you know, against slavery from the very beginning. A lot of these men did things incrementally because they read the room and said, you know, I want to do this, or I think this is the right thing, but the country's not going to go for that. They had to do it piecemeal.
I mean, when you think about it, it's basic human psychology. If the head of your television station said, this is what we're going to do, without giving you any background, without giving you time to process it and reflect it and understand what this ultimate strategy is all about. He's just imposing a directive. Well, you go, that's unpleasant. But if somebody will say, okay, folks, I know where you are, I know what you're thinking, but I want you to be thinking about something else. For example, in the fireside chat, instead of saying, I'm coming to talk to you tonight about the need for us to get involved in a war, he knew they didn't want to hear that. But he said, I'm coming to talk to you tonight about the issue of national security. Mm. That's a softer word, and obviously everybody wants national security. Mm. And then subsequently, on a later fireside chat, he says, look, pull out your atlas. You see where Hitler is? I'm assuming you have some grasp of the power of weapons these days. He's on the verge of gaining a foothold in the Western Hemisphere. And so if we just stay behind, he's going to get that foothold, and he'll be ready to attack us. I don't think anybody wants that. So again, as you say, Jason, it's about incremental as a way of getting people to buy in toward your ultimate conclusion.
It's a long game, definitely. And then finally, the other Roosevelt, too, Teddy Roosevelt, who famously recruited the Rough Riders from the hotel bar in San Antonio.
We think of Theodore Roosevelt, and we think of those Rough Riders, and we think about the Spanish-American War and battlefield glory, because he talked about that a lot. He wanted everybody to think of him in those terms. And yet, as I cover in the Theodore Roosevelt chapter, he was an incredibly great diplomat, peacemaker. He started out year one of his presidency, the Great Coal Strike, 1902. Coal miners are on strike. Months go by, no progress in working out a deal with the owners. No American president had ever been involved in a labor dispute before. Theodore Roosevelt says, if I don't get involved, the winter's coming. We're going to have half the country freezing to death because there's no coal. So he gets in, he brings the sides together, he leans on both sides, he brainstorms possible ways of finding common ground. They come up with something in terms of them agreeing to binding arbitration. Problem solved. Nobody freezes to death.
It really was an expansion of the presidency, wasn't it?
Big time.
And he was known for that.
Well, and that was one of the first things he did to expand the presidency. Mm-hmm. But because of the success with the coal strike, next thing you know, Japan and Russia are at war. They can't bring an end to it. They say, hey, President Roosevelt, could you come see if maybe you can get peace with us the way you did with the coal strike workers? And he does. And for it, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. So an incredibly gifted peacemaker mediator. But as you say also, he did expand the presidency, not just in terms of labor disputes, but obviously our national parks and national wildlife refuges and busting trusts and getting the Panama Canal. So he was expanding it in ways that were good for the country, that made us better both at home and abroad.
An incredibly smart president, too. We left out one, by the way,
who
tends to get left out a lot, I think, and that's Eisenhower.
Oh.
Yeah. Eisenhower, he's rated number five, and that's...
You just don't hear a lot of people say much about Eisenhower.
Well, Harry Truman once said it takes 50 years for the dust to settle to figure out what the ultimate legacy was, and it took a while to kick in on Eisenhower's greatness. But when you realize that for his 8 years, the first thing he did was he brought an end to the Korean War, which Truman couldn't do. He then dealt with McCarthyism and came up with a strategy that gave McCarthy enough rope to hang himself, which he did in the Army McCarthy hearings. And from that point on, it's peace and prosperity. People in the media and other politicians thought, oh, this is old guy, he plays too much golf. Other people are running the government, he's kind of a background figure. When his papers were finally released to scholars a few years after his presidency, they realized, no, he was in the big middle of everything. He was the decision maker. He was the smartest guy in the room. He's responsible for all these years of peace and prosperity. And so that's why it took time, but over time, for the last two C-SPAN polls, he's been ranked number five.
Let me ask about another president that I've always thought of as having some leadership qualities. LBJ, another Texan. Civil Rights Act, you mentioned how, you know, obviously it was started with President Kennedy, but he to get that passed, he gave up Southern Democrats to the Republican Party, and they're still in the Republican Party today. And then he goes on to say, you know, I shall not accept, and I will not seek, I shall not accept another term for president. He gave up the most powerful job in the world. What do you think about him?
Well, you would say he gave it up. In fact, he was pushed out. His life had become unbearable because of the Vietnam War. So in the 2017 C-SPAN poll, if Reagan was ranked 9th, LBJ 10th. Hmm. In the 2021 poll, believe it or not, Reagan 9th, Obama 10th, LBJ 11th. Hmm. I think Obama's ranking's going to come down. Per Truman, it takes a while for the dust to settle.
Do you think he'll rank higher over time? Or
no, lower.
Lower, okay.
I mean, there's nothing good about his foreign policy. There wasn't much good about his domestic policy. He was eloquent, although unlike Kennedy and the others, his words didn't really inspire the country to do great things. There was no scandal. He always handled himself very professionally. But back to LBJ, the scar of Vietnam is a scar that will not go away, that will never elevate. As great as the civil rights and other programs, some of which were great, some of which didn't work at all and were disastrous, but Vietnam, I truly believe, and I think anybody who studied it, was a question that had no answers. What to do about it? There was no obvious, clear policy to be followed that would have resulted in a great result. So the fact that he couldn't figure it out, he made the decision to escalate. It was a disaster, but so many people, I think, would have done the same thing. There's an open question as to whether Kennedy would have done the same thing had right. he not been assassinated. But where it really comes down on LBJ is throughout the Vietnam War, he is repeatedly lying to the American people. And for that, that's a hard one to forgive. And to think somebody should be elevated who's been in the business of consistently lying to the American people about the war that we're involved in. Huh.
When you go through this stuff as deeply as you did, do you get the sense, because on the surface it looks like in some of these cases, that these men were almost chosen for their time, that they had the perfect fit, the perfect characteristics for what was required of them?
And that's when there's magic, when you have the right person at the right time. Unfortunately, for the most part, they're not consecutive. Hmm. In fact, none of them were consecutive. Mm-hmm. And so we sit here today in 2024 and we think about today's candidates. And in fact, the great American middle right now is not 30%, it's 70% who don't want either of these two candidates. Mm-hmm. One of these two guys is gonna win. We just hope the country survives these 4 years, and then hopefully we'll have a new batch of younger leaders who will have these, at least some of these 24 leadership traits.
Is that hyperbole though, hoping the country will survive?
No, that's my personal thought, because as I've said in my Dallas Morning News editorials, I regard both of them with each passing day. One of them becomes more cognitively dysfunctional, the other becomes more psychologically unhinged. I think they are equally dangerous, and the prospect of either of them having a second term is not something that I look to favorably. And in my conversations with other leading journalists and historians, I don't think anybody is looking to the next 4 years with a sense of optimism with either of these two most recent presidents at the helm.
Talmadge, we've been hearing that democracy is on the line with this vote. We heard that the last time around as well. Knowing what you know after all of the research that you've done on these eight greats, as you say, how much does the characteristics of one man threaten a whole idea of democracy? Is it possible for one man with the wrong characteristics to take down democracy?
I think it is possible. I mean, you know, Huey Long came close, and of course, not in the United States, but Hitler and now Putin. I mean, demagogues have very influential power on those who are susceptible to that type of approach. So every 4 years, everybody says, oh, this is the most important election in history. That goes without saying, that's what people always see. But between this choice of these two, with Biden, who'd be 82 on Inauguration Day, and his Vice President Kamala Harris, who has demonstrated she doesn't have a clue about what it would take to, if she had to step into Biden's shoes, which is certainly a possibility at his age. And then of course, Trump, election denial, January 6th, indictments all over the place. To repeat myself, this is a very dangerous time, and whoever people decide to vote for, we gotta go into it with our eyes open, recognizing real danger here. And so hopefully, Our Supreme Court will continue to enforce the laws. Hopefully we'll have a strong Congress who can provide this balance of power to make sure that the executive branch does not take control.
But you see them as equally dangerous. Would you even cast a vote?
At this point, I tell people, if I vote for somebody for president and that president wins, then I necessarily must take responsibility for that person's presidency. And I am unwilling to take responsibility for either of these two. I'm going to let other people do that and vote and accept the choice you make. And if that person wins, you're responsible. And maybe that president in his second term is going to pleasantly surprise all of us, and nobody be happier about that than I would be.
But I think about how divided we are in this country right now, and I wondered as I was, you know, preparing and thinking about your book here, and I thought, is there the possibility of another great president again? Are we too divided? Will we ever be able to, you know, a lot of us agree that this is a great president who's in there now? But then I thought about it, and, you know, a lot of these men served at times that were horribly divided as well, and they probably thought the same thing then, you know, like, oh, we're too divided to agree on this.
But they emerged, and so, to your point, I mean, I was hoping No Labels was going to produce a candidate who would be a unity candidate, and I wrote Dallas Morning News editorial saying that. I thought Nikki Haley is potentially a great president, and I was sorry that she didn't win in the Republican primaries. I thought Ben Sasse, the former senator from Nebraska, had everything it took to become a great president. But he quit the Senate, and he's now the head of the University of Florida. So there are great younger leaders on the American scene, but unfortunately, the Democrats, for whatever reason, won't put anybody else up, despite all the flaws in both Biden and Harris. And obviously Trump has control of the Republican Party in 2024. It doesn't matter how eloquent and what a great debater Nikki Haley was. It didn't matter. Trump has the Republican Party in his total control, and there was nothing, obviously, that she could do to change that.
Is this country, though, capable, do you think, of ever producing that again and having that, you know, camaraderie across party lines to have broad agreement that, you know, someone is great?
Well, my friend Ken Burns likes to quote Mark Twain, who said, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes." Mm. And so I like to think that just as throughout our history, from time to time, we have had great presidents who arose in moments of crisis, who took us out of the woods and the wilderness and took us to a higher place. I'm an optimistic person. I'm hopeful that that will happen in our future. It's certainly not going to happen in the next 4 years, but I have confidence in the future after the next 4 years when both of these current presumptive nominees will be gone from the American political scene.
Thomas, last question for you. If we consider what you know, was said about Dwight Eisenhower and how it takes history 50 years to recognize greatness. Truman said that. Do you think history might look back more favorably on George W. Bush, on Barack Obama, on Joe Biden, Donald Trump?
I can't imagine it looking more favorably on Trump or Biden. And based on what I know about Obama and what he did, I don't have expectations that he's going to rise above his current 10th place. And as I said, I think he'll go down. George W. Bush, I think his stock will rise. I don't think he's ever going to be a top eight president. But what I don't think he gets enough credit for is after 9/11, he vowed this is not going to happen again, and it didn't. And so to protect the country from another terrorist attack was no small achievement. He gets a lot of flack for the Iraq war when all he did was rely on the very best intelligence that was available, which the Democrats believed, which the other Republicans believed. He believed it. It turned out to be wrong. And everybody says, oh, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. I don't agree with that. His PEPFAR program has saved tens of millions of lives in Africa. And even Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times has written a column that praises him. And obviously, George W. Bush has conducted himself in exemplary fashion in his post-presidency. This coming Sunday, I've got an op-ed piece in the Morning News that talks about what a fabulous place for history and public enjoyment and making memories the George W. Bush Presidential Center and Library is. So we here in Dallas are incredibly blessed to have that library, to have him in our presence, he and his wife, people of deep faith, high integrity, who I have the highest regard for, and I think in time he will be moving up in how his presidency is evaluated.
My last one for you is, you know, the book obviously is, you know, it's a retrospective, it's history, it's looking back at these different presidents and the qualities that they had. But as we said at the outset, this is for anyone to become a better leader and learn from some of these characteristics that these men possessed. And I'm curious, you tried not to repeat between each individual one, but was there a common thread that sort of knitted together all eight of these men, and something that maybe even you, you know, as a researcher on this, thought, I could get better at that too. That would be a good thing.
There are three common threads. Number one, they were all self-aware. They all knew their strengths, they knew their weaknesses. For what they were particularly good at, they found ways to use them. For what they knew they weren't very good at, they brought in people who were strong in the areas where they were weak in order to solve that problem. That's true of all of them. Number two, they were all great persuaders. Mm. Some of them were great persuaders as eloquent spokesmen, Lincoln, FDR, Kennedy, Reagan. But the other four, Washington, Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, not great public speakers, but great interpersonally one-on-one persuaders. And then third, and as important and tying into what some of the things we've been talking about, all of them led the nation with their eyes on the great American middle. They were not thinking about, well, what do the extreme on the right think? What do the extreme on the left think? I want to conduct my policies in ways that'll please the extremes. No, it was the middle way. That's the way government is effective, when it's led by leaders who are focused on that. And that's a reason we find ourselves with both Trump and Biden, who have governed with their eyes on the extremes and not on the middle way. And that's why both of them have had, in my opinion, such unsuccessful presidencies.
You've had a lot of great press on this fantastic book. Have you had beer with the other interviewers before?
No.
Doris Kearns Goodwin didn't
have
a beer
offer
with
you
before
no.
She
I will put in a plug. Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book came out on June the 16th. She will be in Dallas. On April the 16th.
Yeah.
She'll be in Dallas on June the 14th.
Yeah.
And I'll be interviewing her during the noon hour at the Sixth Floor Museum. And then that evening, she's doing a program at the Dallas Center for the Performing Arts, sponsored by the World Affairs Council of DFW. Hmm. So her book is terrific.
And she endorsed a paragraph in your book.
Well, she endorsed the chapter, the FDR.
Chapter.
No, the entire chapter
on
FDR.
I've never seen an endorsement of a chapter.
Well,
that's interesting.
I thought, to give myself credibility, that there aren't this kind of global BS blurbs that you see on so many books that don't really mean anything, that for each of these biographers of my eight presidents to say, no, I've read this chapter, and this chapter nails it. Hopefully that gives people confidence in the chapter and in me as a historian to know that the country's leading presidential historians have blessed my conclusions.
I think that does give credence. I think most people would think, well, I need to get them to endorse the whole book.
Uh-huh.
No, get them to, you know, endorse the part that's their wheelhouse. That's
right.
Their specialty.
That was the idea.
Very smart. Very smart.
Our guest today, Talmadge Boston. He's an attorney. I don't know when you have time to practice. Author and historian. His book out available right now on Amazon, wherever you can get your books, is called How the Best Did It. Leadership lessons from the top eight presidents. Fantastic insight on these presidents that I think a lot of people know a lot about, but might not know these nuggets, as David Stewart points out.
Yeah, thanks for sifting through the gravel pit for those. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, and thanks for having me on your program.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV and watch the latest episode of Y'allitics each Wednesday night at 8:30.